Reading a new chapter. I think we may finish it today. There's some really great purports near the beginning. Then after that, it goes kind of smoothly. So let's do a bit of an overview. Okay, what happened to my overview? A bit of an overview of the first part, anyway. So Brahma, you know, Lord has departed, or is departing, and Lord Brahma is beginning to act. He's going to do the Visarga, the subsequent creation. And so Vidura asks a question, how did Brahma proceed with the creation afterwards? And Sutta Goswami speaking, right? So we have Vidura, it's conversations within conversations within conversations, right? Maitreya is speaking to Vidura. Sukadev is speaking to Maharaj Parikshit. And now Sutta is speaking to the sages of Naimasharanya, okay? And Prabhupada points out that nothing is lost. Because this is the parampara system. Actually, things are gained if the parampara system works properly. So Brahma meditates for 100 celestial years. He sat along the waters of of devastation. They began to rock violently, and there was a furious wind. And Brahma got by performing devotional austerities, he got the intelligence and the strength to do his service. So he drank up the water and the wind. Within the lotus, Brahma could see all the planets and living entities in seedling form. And then he entered the lotus and began his service by disseminating those seeds all over the universe. So that's kind of what we'll talk about now. And then after, when we get to text 10, we'll give a little more background. Okay, so text number one. Sri Vidura said, "O great sage, please let me know how Brahma, the grandfather of the planetary inhabitants, created the bodies of the living entities from his own body and mind after the disappearance of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. O greatly learned one, kindly eradicate all my doubts and let me know of all that I have inquired from you from the beginning to the end." And Prabhupada writes, "Vidura asked all relevant questions of Maitreya because he knew well that Maitreya was the right person to reply to all the points of his inquiries. One must be confident about the qualifications of his teacher. One should not approach a layman for replies to specific spiritual inquiries. Such inquiries, when replied to with imaginative answers by the teacher, are a program for wasting time." So this is actually the topic of the Sunday open house today, about questions and answers. And what does Srila Prabhupada say? Something like, one should ask relevant questions. I believe it's in, does anyone have Bhagavad Gita with them? In the Gita 434, Tadviti Paripatrina, the purport, Srila Prabhupada talks there about absurd inquiries, I think is the, and what's the other half of the sentence? Yes, in this verse, both blind following and absurd inquiries are condemned. Right, so we shouldn't blindly follow, and we shouldn't ask really dumb questions. And now I lost my place where we were in the Bhagavatam. Here we go. So we should, the Prabhupada gives the simple example that just like a husband and wife who are trying to beget a child. So the husband should be potent and the woman should be fertile, right? Yeah. And so the speaker should ask good questions, but they shouldn't be afraid of, we shouldn't be afraid, not they out there, but we shouldn't be afraid of getting our doubts addressed. We shouldn't just sweep them under the carpet of neglect. and hope that they'll go away one day, because they usually come back to bite us. Right, Michael? Because he asks the toughest questions. I didn't mean you have doubts, but he asks the hardest questions. It's like, suffrage. Never thought of that. So we should ask questions like Michael does, tough questions sometimes, and all of you ask good questions. And then the speaker should be qualified. So that's questionable in this case. But the only thing I can say is that I guess for 40 some odd years, I've listened to Prabhupada's answers and studied them. So I don't know if I have any qual, but that's at least something. So, because I was preparing for this class, this Sunday open house class, the last few days, and yesterday my wife and I had three engagements we were going to, so we did a lot of driving, and we were talking about these points. And so, Srila Prabhupada mentions in several places that especially in spiritual times, when we, did that mean? No. We should reply to answers according to the Bhagavad Gita or according to Shastra. You know, that a learned person quotes Shastra. That doesn't mean we should be parrots, right? Right? We shouldn't just, yes, Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, Aham Sarvasya Prabhava Matasa. You know, we should speak from Shastra and then speak in our, as Prabhupada would say, use our, in our own words, is what he said. And then, as we're going to hear in the Sunday open house class also, according to the time, the place, and the circumstance. All right, just like Dinanath Prabhu was giving a Bhagavatam class yesterday, in the temple here. And he was talking about, he was in Mayapur when there was nothing. They had just bought the land, and Prabhupada told the devotees to go there. And he said, literally, they were just in a tent, and it was just the coconut trees and the snakes. That was it. There was nothing. And he hasn't been to Mayapur since. Imagine when he goes there now. I'd be shocked, right? So he was saying that they didn't really have much to do either. Probably just told him that, how when you buy land in India, you want someone there, right? You don't want to, because squatters' rights and all that sort of stuff. So they were just there. And so one day Prabhupada said, yes, you can go see Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur's brother. So they went to see him. The brother spoke on very, very high things. And the devotees were all pretty new to Krishna consciousness. So it just kind of went over their heads. So when they told Srila Prabhupada that, he said, no, then you don't go see him anymore. Right? So the time, place, and circumstance is important. Just like this class, I speak a little differently than the Sunday open house class because we're trying to aim that to everyone, but especially to new people. Harbal, right? There's some direction in that direction, something. Whereas here we assume that people are more familiar with Srila Prabhupada, and especially those two in the back, they are the most familiar. Right? Talking about you guys. So, and if we ask bad questions or we get imaginative answers, it is a program for wasting time. Right? So another place we Prabhupada talks about how those questions and answers are there all day long. He said even the birds are asking questions and answers. So it would be interesting if we had one of those little counters and we clicked every time we asked a question during the day. See how many questions we actually ask. We'd be so conscious of it, that would probably be tough. But, you go to work, there's so many questions, right? Constantly. You come home, is it offered yet? That's my wife's most least favorite question that I ask. Is it offered yet? Why don't you offer? That's what she said. Is it offered yet? Or the other thing, is this offered? So now we have a little sticker with a smiley face on it, and that goes on anything that's offered in the house, so it's clear what's offered and what's not offered. Good. She doesn't like absurd questions very much. Some questions on questions or comments on questions? No? It's clear? Okay. So the next verse. Oops, what's happening? Oh, there we go. Verse number 3. Sutta said, Sutta Goswami said, O son of Bhrighu, the great sage Maitreya Muni, thus hearing from Vidura, felt very much enlivened. Everything was in his heart, and thus he began to reply to the questions one after another. So that's another point, is that good questions, the speaker gets enlivened. You know, good questions. That's why we like Michael so much. Yeah, such good questions. You know, so the speaker gets enlivened. The greatly learned sage Maitreya said, O Vidura, Brahma thus engaged himself in penances for 100 celestial years. That's a long time. As advised by the personality of Godhead, and implied himself in devotional service to the Lord. And a short purport, that Brahma engaged himself for the personality of Godhead, Narayana, means that he engaged himself in the service of the Lord. That is the highest penance one can perform for any number of years. There is no retirement from such service, which is eternal and ever encouraging. So I have a friend of mine. I was speaking to him the other day on the phone, and we were on a conference. You know how when you're on a conference call and you're the first people there, so you know you exchange niceties while you're waiting. So he said, "How are you?" And I said, "I'm okay." And he said, "Just okay? What's the matter with you? You're serving the Supreme Personality of Godhead. You're serving Prabhupada's mission. This is the most ecstatic thing you could possibly do in all the three worlds, and you're just okay?" I said, "I'm ecstatic, Prabhu." So it's ever encouraging. Devotional service is ever encouraged. Anandam buddhivardhanam, right? What does that mean? Ever expanding what? Yes, ever expanding. So, you know, we're not fully tasting that. We're doing something a little wrong, or we're not there yet, at least, right? So it's eternal. What does that mean? That's an interesting question, because someone say it's eternal. Well, you know, after this class is over, it's over. It's not, the class isn't eternal, right? And that, you know, Paneer Sabji you just had wasn't eternal. And even the Artik had a beginning and an end. So what does it mean when it says devotional service is eternal? Everlasting. Okay. And what do you mean by lasting? So let's look at everlasting. Inexhaustible. There's no, you don't get exhausted when you perform it. Okay. You never get tired at the end of the day of full devotional service? When you've handed 2,000 japa beads out to people, like Jamastami. That's okay. No, I'm just trying to get this. What does it mean when we say it's eternal?
The benefits of performing the devotional service.
Yes, and then that connects with Mataji's statement, everlasting. The benefits are everlasting. And it goes in the bank account, so to speak. Permanent bank account, yes. So it leads to eternal devotional service. In the spiritual world, that's all you're doing. And on a certain level, time acts differently. Because Srila Prabhupada says, devotional service and the kingdom of God are non-different. So the benefits, at least, are timeless. Like that. And so there's no retirement. So we don't retire. We don't say, okay, I've done bhakti and I've gotten really good at it. Now I'm going to take up scuba diving, right? Or jnana yoga, for that matter, or karma yoga, or basket weaving, or, you know, Formula One race car driving, or whatever, right? We don't retire from the service. That doesn't mean that when our body goes through transformations, we don't take up different kinds of service. Right? So when I was a brahmacharya, I did a certain kind of service. As a grihastha, a certain kind of service. Vanaprastha, in the first canto, Srila Prabhupada talks about Vanaprastha's even going to Vrindavan and studying the books of the six Goswamis. Right? So we may do different kinds of service, but it's still service. So in that sense, there's no retirement. So if Vanaprastha retires, right? Right? Just like Mahamantrapu is becoming, he'll have less responsibilities. His daughter's in college. His son is going to college next year. Right, so time is acting on life. And so responsibilities may be different. And soon, Panchu will be so rich, he'll be supporting Mataji and Prabhuji, and they can just do full-time service. But you get the idea, right? Time moves on. So that's what's meant by retirement. We may retire from our occupation, for example, from our job. Right? Matter of fact, it's good to do that towards the end of life. But we'll still be doing devotional service. So that's what it says here. Such a nice sentence. There's no retirement from such service, which is eternal and ever encouraging. Some thoughts on that? Microphone's right behind you.
Hare Krishna Prabhu. It also reminds me of the verse in Bhagavad Gita, Susukam Kartum Avya. It's devotional service is joyfully performed. And yeah, even at a very neophyte stage I am practicing, I can experience something and reciprocation from Krishna, which is encouraging for me to keep moving forward in that path. And Krishna is like keeps attracting in that way for me to go forward and keep advancing.
Mm. I hear that when they have the debriefs at the end of the Sunday serve, that people, the devotees who do that they share realizations about how nice it is to render service, something like that. Yes, but what, a microphone?
My realization on devotional service is, even if you don't know, just like that, as soon as you surrender, it's automatically Krishna is taking care, like, he's aligning you, even if you are not aware, like, your spiritual growth is, like, going.
Yes. And there's also agyata sukriti, right? Even people who don't know anything and render some service and they feel some happiness. Yeah. Yeah. I've several times told, how Jayananda Prabhu was very, really understood that point. And he was always engaging people. He would be underneath a car, fixing a car, and ask somebody walking by, could you hand me the wrench over there? Just knowing that they would make progress by doing that agyata sukriti, right? Or people who take prasadam, they don't necessarily know that it's sukriti. It's devote bhakti sukriti to take prasadam, but they make advancement, right? Well, is that not on?
Yeah. He keeps you attracted also, like...
Krishna keeps you attracted, yes, because he's all attractive. Yeah. So devotional service doesn't... it's not something that you just move on from. That's the idea, right? Because the other yogas, you ultimately move on from them. Karma yoga, jnana yoga, raja yoga, etc. But then Krishna says in the last verse of the sixth chapter, yoginam api sarvesham matkatena taratmana, that the highest of all the yogis, the bhakti yogi is supreme. And then there's no mataparataram nanyat, Kintidashti Janandaya. There's nothing higher. It's the highest. So that's why there's no retirement, it's eternal, and it's ever encouraging. Any other thoughts? Okay. So then we're on text 5. Thereafter, Brahma saw that both the lotus on which he was situated, and the water on which the lotus was growing was trembling due to a strong, violent wind. Prabhupada writes, the material world is called illusion or illusory because it is a place of forgetfulness of the transcendental service of the Lord. Thus, when engaged in the Lord's devotional service in the material world, may sometimes be very much disturbed by awkward circumstances. So sometimes we'll forget the service of the Lord. There is a declaration of war between the two parties, the illusory energy and the devotee. And sometimes the weak devotees fall victim to the onslaught, bless you, of the powerful illusory energy. Lord Brahma, however, was sufficiently strong by the causeless mercy of the Lord, and he could not be victimized by the material energy, although it gave him cause for anxiety when it managed to totter the existence of his position. So, a declaration of war, when there's a... Imagine how much people were on high alert in America after Pearl Harbor, right? Thinking, what'll be the next thing, right? I remember where, I don't know, it was, where were you on 9/11? You're in New Jersey? You're in New Jersey?
I was in California.
You're in California? New Jersey. New Jersey. India. India. Were you born yet? They were, some of them were not born yet. Let's see, 2001, you'd be 16. A little smaller one was on. Okay, cool. Mataji, where were you on 9/11? Yes. Here. Acha. Michael?
I was by Providence Hospital.
Uh-huh.
My father was going to leave that day. He was on a visit, and he had to stay because all the planes were grounded.
All the planes were grounded, yes. I was in Belgium on my way to America. Yeah. My wife said, because we didn't, you know, it was, right? People just thought maybe this is the end of it. You know, she said, come back to India. Come back to India. But I was going to get my mother and bring her to India. So I just waited a few days. But anyway, the idea was it was a very tottering time, if you remember, right? We were mainly listening to BBC to hear the news. And I was at Radhadesh, the temple there. No devotees had television. So we had to go to the neighbor's house, who wasn't a devotee, and watch, you know. But radios were, you know, so we were listening on the radio. But the idea is that it was a very time of uncertainty, of great uncertainty, right? There's all kinds of speculations about what will happen and all that, and who did it, and et cetera. So Brahma was in a time of, the whole universe was shaking. And even though it caused him some anxiety, because of his strength in devotional service, he remained strong. It says, Lord Brahma, however, was sufficiently strong by the causeless mercy of the Lord, and he could not be victimized by the material energy. So another statement of Srila Prabhupada's that the only complaint I have about my devotees is that they are not sufficiently afraid of Maya. So we don't have to be like Markandeya Rishi who, like, you know, said, please show me your Maya. We don't need to do that. We're already quite familiar with Maya, the illusory energy. And this idea of declaring war, that means to... It's an interesting question because or interesting concept, because we should be on alert not to fall into Maya. And the nature of that war is not like we think of war in the world. Right, the war is to take shelter of Krishna. Actually, I was just reading something. It's gonna mess up my spot here on Vedabase, but it was so nice that I will read. I was reading Partana today, the prayers of Narottama Das Thakur, and let's see if I can find it quickly. So nice, such a beautiful. Series of prayers. Here we go. So I'll just read the English, but it says, O Lord Hari, please be merciful and keep me safe at your lotus feet. So that's the kind of war we're at. We're at the war of bhakti, you know, of feeling the shelter of Krishna's lotus feet. Narottam goes on to say, the six enemies headed by lust and anger, which are Maya, are dragging me to different places, enticing me to enjoy my senses in various ways. Forgetting you, I became a servant of Maya and desired so many things for myself. After a great deal of suffering, you kindly tied your rope of mercy around my neck and brought me back to Vrindavan. So if you kindly once again catch my hair and pull me out of the well and place me in Braj Dham, only then can I be saved. Thus prays poor Narottama Das. So nice, huh? So please be merciful and keep me safe at your lotus feet. What a nice prayer. That's something we can pray. We can pray that regularly. Keep me safe, Ramadamahanji, please keep me safe at your lotus feet. That's the kind of war we're at. Not like, you know, and even gritting our teeth and I'm not going to engage in sense gratification. That doesn't work as well as praying to be sheltered at Krishna's lotus feet. That's the safety. That's the war on Maya that we want to declare. So some thoughts on verse 5. Yes, microphone. Yep.
Like in Garga Samhita, the universe is compared to a fig.
To a what?
Like a fig.
Fig.
And then half filled with garbha waters and half with space. Right. And upper planetary systems and lower planetary system.
Yes.
And Garbhodakshaya Vishnu lies down. And the lotus stem that comes, and now Brahma is on the top.
Mm-hmm.
And the stem has the planetary systems.
Right.
So, about this wind, and the whole universe is swaying. Like, what is going on, Prabhu?
That, what's going on? Raghunandan Prabhu will tell you. You mean what's going on here?
Lord Vishnu, he gave him the promise that you'll be safe,
right,
from the onslaught of,
right,
this thing. And then immediately we see the wind trying to sway him, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I understand it is Leela, but what is going on there?
Well, like, you know, maybe the Lord is testing him. Just the Lord tested Srila Prabhupada.
Okay.
Right? A matter of fact, the Lord often glorifies his devotees when they go through trials and tribulations, the Pandavas, who else? Prahlad Maharaj, Dhruva Maharaj, right? Srila Prabhupada, you know, he tells that story about the time when he was in New York, in the Upper East Side, very wealthy people, and he was alone with that lady, and he was just praying, Krishna, please protect me, right? And of course, Krishna protected him. But so here, Brahma is glorified because he did not become victimized by the material energy.
Yeah.
That's all I can say. Mm-hmm. What it says here.
And then the next is like, he drank the water.
He planned the war?
He drank the water.
He drank the water, yes.
And the wind, right?
Yes.
So now, like, the planetary system that is inside the stem,
mm-hmm,
right? And that's where the living entities are?
It's very...
So,
from
I'm
the description here, we don't get a full enough description. Yeah. We do know that when Lord Vishnu glances at Pradhan,
yeah,
and it changes into Mahatattva, in that glance is the living entities, the time factor, and one other thing. Their karma.
Yeah.
Living entities, right. Karma.
And
at that point of time, I don't think the planetary systems are in place yet, because Brahma is the one that creates the planetary systems and populates them with the living entities.
So maybe the potential for the
Mahatattva was present, but not the planetary systems. That's my understanding of reading those sections. Yeah. Because at that point of time, there's nothing yet. It's an empty shell, and it has Mahatattva because of the glance of Mahavishnu. That's it.
I don't know more than what's stated here. We can do some research and maybe look into Sariputta Prabhu's books for some more explanation. Anything else? Okay, then let's go on to text 6. Long penance and transcendental knowledge of self-realization had matured Brahma in practical knowledge, and thus he drank the wind completely along with the water. Lord Brahma's struggle for existence is a personal example of the continued fight between the living entities in the material world and the illusory energy called Maya. Beginning from Brahma down to this age, the living entities are struggling with the forces of material nature. By advanced knowledge in science and transcendental realization, one can try to control the material energy, which works against our endeavors. And in the modern age, advanced material scientific knowledge and penance have played very wonderful roles in controlling the powers of the material energy. Such control of the material energy, however, can be most successfully carried out if one is a soul surrendered unto the Supreme Personality of Godhead and carries out his order in the spirit of loving transcendental service. So Prabhupada here speaks rather kindly of modern scientific knowledge, doesn't he? But it doesn't cure the existential struggle that we have between our real self as our swarup, as Krishna's servant, and our illusory identification as an enjoyer of this world. And that's what's, and so the best thing, the most successful way, is to approach the Lord in a spirit of loving transcendental service. So some thoughts on this. Yes.
There are times when people have this thought once in a while about, you know, existentialism, and you get confused. And how do you come out of it? And what do you do about it?
Well, okay. First, we have to define existentialism. So we'll turn to Wiki Gurudev. Existentialism. Well. A philosophical theory or approach that emphasizes the existence of the individual person as a free and responsible agent determining their own development through acts of the will. Is that okay as a definition? Okay. So that is half correct. Well, half correct means that we have, so it says here, it's free and responsible agent, okay? So we have freedom, we just don't have complete freedom, right? We have, for example, we chose to come here today rather than, you know, go to a park or, you know, sleep in or go to the Baltimore Temple or whatever, right? We exercised our free will, and we have free... I just exercise my free will to lift my left hand and then my right, and et cetera. We don't have unlimited free will, right? Because we can't, for example, avoid death. We can't, for example, totally avoid illness, right? We can take all the vitamin E in the world and all the supplements, but generally speaking, something gets us. We can't avoid getting older, right? We didn't choose our parents. That wasn't an act totally of free will. They were chosen for us, for example. So the Shastra, the Vedic wisdom, accepts existentialism to a certain extent. And then there's other things at play. let's see, there's a, that was a very short, is a term applied to the work of certain 19th and 20th century European philosophers who, despite profound doctrinal differences, shared the belief that philosophical thinking begins with the human subject, not merely the thinking subject, but the acting, feeling, and living human individual. That's a little more detailed. So it's interesting here, though. It says acting, feeling. We have thinking, feeling, and willing, right? That's those English words translated from the Sanskrit. And it's interesting, they go in a line, thinking first, then feeling, then willing, right? Like, we think, oh, maybe I should go to the temple today. Feeling, oh, yeah, you know, it's actually so nice, Shanti, deities are so beautiful, so many nice association. And not only that, but nice lunch, prasadam, and so many things, right? And then we get a strong desire, we will it, and we get in the car, turn on the ignition, and away we go. So there is a lot of similarities with, here it says Kierkegaard was one of the key people in it, but we'd have to look at it a little bit more carefully to see what is the connection with God in existentialism. But certainly the fact that we have free will is factual, but it's just not, it's a question of how we use the free will. That's what the Vedic wisdom would say. So we have free will, and now how do we use it? Do we use it only in, like an animal does, in a polished way, but eating, sleeping, mating, and defending? Or do we choose to think philosophically and devotionally about a higher being and what our relationship is with that higher being? And so I could study this more, but on the spot, that's my answer. Is that okay? Microphone?
Son had once asked me recently about existentialism, and he said that you know, he's about 19 years old, and he said, "Well, if we're all going to die one day, right? And so, what's the point of struggling and working hard and doing all this when the end result is the same for everybody?" So, you know,
he's a very smart 19-year-old.
So I struggled with the answer mm-hmm. to that. And so I just wanted to see how I can counteract that argument.
Well, it's not totally wrong. Yeah, we have to look at the pluses and minuses. There's a lot of gray areas in life, not just black and white, right? So he is accurate in saying that you don't want to example I use a lot. You don't want to climb up the ladder of success your whole life and then find at the end of life is leaning against the wrong wall, right? So it's a fact. Just working hard, becoming the CEO of a company and having a yacht and a Mercedes or a Maserati if you're really rich, or Ferrari if you're really, really rich, or a house in Potomac, you still are, as Srila Prabhupada would, our guru would say sometimes, that, you know, rich man and poor man still, same limit, 3 or 4 chapatis, right? You know, so there's some wisdom in what he's saying. It's not the traditional Jewish or Indian family way of preaching, right? Not at all. But there's some truth that you just work hard, and for what? It doesn't necessarily, success doesn't necessarily equate happiness, right? Now, having said that, the Vedic wisdom goes beyond that, right? And it says that we're a soul, and we have a relationship with God, and this human form has a purpose. It's not just purposeless, because we all end up ashes to ashes, dust to dust, right? Like the Bible says. But it has a purpose, and that purpose is to reestablish our relationship with Krishna, with God. And so then we might want to, you know, we can take different paths to that goal, right? Your 19-year-old could, if he was really, really, really serious, could be a brahmachari his whole life, and you know, never marry and just dedicate his whole life to God. Not too many people do that. But he could get married and have a family and even want to be successful then, and then use some of the fruits of that success as service to Krishna. And then that work has more meaning. You know, I have a colleague at work who said this to me the other day, and I was just thinking, oh, what an empty life. Because this person was just saying, okay, they want to go, they live in Virginia and the office is in D.C. where I work. And so they get up at 4:30 in the morning and they start driving by 5:15, and then they get to work by about 6, and then they work until 3:30 or whatever, 3:30, go home, have dinner, go to the gym, have dinner and go to sleep. And then do the same thing the next day. And I was saying, oh my God. You know, I was saying, I get up, you know, try to get up four, chant Hare Krishna for 2 hours a day, 2 hours till 6, you know, try to read some shastra, right? Read some shastra, take prasadam, come to the temple for darshan, perhaps. Then drive to work and listen to Srila Prabhupada's lecture at work. I chant Gayatri also. Then I do my job and, you know, try to find some time during the day to read some shlokas and things like that. Chant Gayatri at noon. Go home. Pay obeisances to our Giriraj deity. You know, you see the difference, right? there's some differences there because of the connection with Krishna. Mm. So I can see where your son is coming from. You know, he's actually, it means he's a thoughtful person, and you should be very proud of that. Because some people just, you know, really just go through life, you know, just like lemmings, just blindly following the person in front of them, you know. And as Robert Frost wrote in a very beautiful poem, he said, "I took the path less traveled on, and that made all the difference." So, it's good to be thought. You should really encourage. It's very nice to be thoughtful. I'd be happy to. I'd love to talk to him one day, and talk to him about this, because he has part of it right. It doesn't mean, you know, as a mother who I'm sure wants him to be successful and all that, it doesn't mean he can't do that. But you can do that. You can be the CEO of Amazon in different consciousness, right? You can just think it's all for me, or you can think, you know, I'm doing this and I have a purpose in life. Is that all right? Yeah. Is he going to college now? Where is he studying? Grinnell. No wonder he's thoughtful. That's a very good school.
Yeah, actually, he wants to do medicine to help people, but he's doing philosophy.
It sounds like he's doing philosophy. All right. Well, if I can't answer, I'll have him go see Michael. Philosopher. but I would love to talk. Grinnell is a very thought inspiring school. They really, I applied there. I ended up not going there. But yeah, good school. Good. Okay, shall we go on? I said we'd try to finish this today. Text number 7, and we're going from 7 up until 11. 7:11. Thereafter, he saw that the lotus on which he was situated was spread throughout the universe, and he contemplated how to create all the planets which were previously merged in that very same lotus. Thus engaged in the service of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Lord Brahma entered into the world of the lotus, and as it spread all over the universe, he divided it into 3 divisions of worlds, and later into 14 divisions. Lord Brahma is the most exalted personality in the universe because of his causeless devotional service unto the Lord in mature transcendental knowledge. He therefore created all the 14 planetary divisions for inhabitation by the different types of living entities. Vidura inquired from Maitreya, "O my Lord, O greatly learned sage, kindly describe eternal time, which is another form of the Supreme Lord, the wonderful actor. What are the symptoms of this that eternal time, please describe them to us in detail. So let's just, a little summary. This is from Burijan Prabhu's book. And he says that after hearing from Maitreya about the Lord's primal creation, that's Sarga, and his discussion with Brahma, Vidura inquired about time, another of the Supreme Lord's potencies. Time is subtle. It cannot be observed directly. Right? Jeez. You know, you could say the clock, but, you know, the actual time is a subtle energy. You don't, but its effects reveal its existence. Right? Like if you see someone after 20 years, you'll see the time factor has made an impact, right? Or here he says, days turn into nights. That's a time. Summers turn into autumns. We're now spring, right? Years turn into centuries. I was looking at Reed University. It's a university in Oregon. And they had on their website pictures of their school, because they're celebrating their 100th year. So in the 1910s, the 1920s, and 1930s, right? And so you see these pictures. Maybe I have them here, matter of fact. Well, you can't see it very well, but so this is from 1920, right? And so you see all of them, very handsome looking. Matter of fact, interesting, the hairstyles are quite similar to today, right? Kind of shorter and, right? And they all look very happy and young. They're all probably early 20s or late teens, because that's college. So they were born around 1900 then, right, if they're in college, right? Any of them alive today? They'd have to be 117 or so to be alive, right? So then you can go, you can click on the 1930s. Any of them alive today? All look young and youthful. Probably not. They would be born 1910-ish, 1915. They would have to be 102, 100, right? So 1930s, cut them. 1940s, generally, maybe one or two people still alive, right? The last person still alive who was born in the 1800s died yesterday, right? They were 117, 118 years old, right? So maybe when we get up to the 1950s, okay, born in the 30s, so that would be 70, 87 years old. Right? Not so many of them still alive. So you see, the time just marches on. Right? And, you know, somebody 70 years from now will be looking at pictures from the temple of here and all of us, and they'll say, no, I don't think any of those people are alive today. Right? Time has that. But while these people were living, Yamaraj asked, what is the most wonderful thing in the world? All right. And he said, and the answer that Yudhisthira gave is that the most wonderful thing is that people have so much experience of death. Their grandfathers passed away, this passed away, that passed away, and they're thinking, I'm okay. And they're thinking, what's for dinner? All right. So time is the energy of Krishna that moves the creation forward. Time is eternal and irreversible. Maitreya begins by explaining that time is the source of the interaction between the modes of nature. It is the Supreme Lord's catalyst in the material world, and through time, he imposes the cycles of creation, maintenance, and dissolution. So, then a little later, time affects change in the material energy. Maitreya therefore first describes 9 varieties, plus a tenth, of creation, and 3 types of annihilations. The universal annihilation, caused by the fire coming from Anantashesha, and destruction caused by our own actions. Of the 9 creations, the first 6 are categorized as Sarga, that's Krishna's, for they are created directly by the Lord. Each of these creations move from subtle to gross. These are all things we're going to hear at the end of this chapter. That's why I'm reading it now, to just give you an overview. Gradually creating a material prison suitable for us, the prison souls, to inhabit. By interacting with the material energy, the prisoners either make spiritual advancement or add to their sentence. And then he quotes the Sarga. I won't read them. The Sarga creations, because we're going to read them soon. And then Brahma has three creations: the immovable entities, the lower species, and the human beings. Okay. So now we're going to hear very amazing purports by Srila Prabhupada about time. Just incredible. So Vidura, I think I read 10, right? So 11. Maitreya said, eternal time is the primeval source of the interactions of the three modes of material nature. It is unchangeable and limitless, and it works as the instrument of the Supreme Personality of Godhead for his pastimes in the material creation. So listen to this, the second paragraph. The time factor is also explained by modern men in various ways. Some accept it almost as it is explained in the Srimad Bhagavatam. For example, in Hebrew literature, time is accepted in the same spirit as a representation of God. It is stated therein, God, who at sundry times and in diverse manners spoke in time past unto the fathers by the prophets. Metaphysically, time is distinguished as absolute and real. Absolute time is continuous and is unaffected by the speed or slowness of material things. Time is astronomically and mathematically calculated in relation to the speed, change of life, and a particular object. Factually, however, time has nothing to do with the relativities of things. Rather, everything is shaped and calculated in terms of the facility offered by time. Time is the basic measure of the activities of our senses by which we calculate past, present, and future. But in factual calculation, time has no beginning and end. Chanika Pandit says that even a slight fraction of time cannot be purchased with millions of dollars. And therefore, even a moment weight of time lost without profit must be calculated as the greatest loss in life. Time is not subject to any form of psychology, nor are the moments objective realities in themselves, but they are dependent on particular experiences. Now, if you understood all that, you're really amazing. So some points about time. In our perception of time. Hold up, where is it? This is from a devotee. I asked a devotee about this paragraph, and he said the reason it was Kaishori Mataji. The reason we see time as linear is because we measure it by external sense activities rather than by our inner experience. So time is relative. You know, we experience that time is relative, right? Like if you're really bored in this class, you keep on thinking, oh my God, only 5 minutes passed since I checked my watch last time. Is it ever gonna end, right? And so, you know, a very short period of time. Have you ever done that? You look at your watch, it's only 3 minutes, right? And then sometimes when we're really enjoying something and are absorbed in it, then hours can pass and we can feel like a very short amount of time. So even in that sense, time is relative. Time is also relative, we even understand this from modern science, on different planets and what to speak of, you know, a lifespan. So an ant has a lifespan that feels to the ant like a complete life. But for us, it would seem like very short lifespan, right? And similarly, on the higher planets, they have much longer lifespans than us. So time is a very interesting element. And it's very powerful because you can't stop it from marching on, right? You can exercise, and of course you should exercise and vitamin E and all these things, but time marches on. And we all have so many breaths that we will take in this life. Right? And you can't, you know, you can't press the pause button. And it just moves on and on. And it seems to be linear, although we understand also in the cosmic sense of the idea that time is cyclical. And therefore the yugas are cyclical, satya, treta, dwapara, kali, like that. And time is conspicuous by its absence in the spiritual world. A little hard to figure out what that means, exactly, because we also understand, you know, Krishna gets up in the morning and has his activities, but they're nitya-lila, they're eternal. So time is our friend. There's a nice verse, Ayur Harati Vai Pungsang. Does anyone know that verse in the second canto of the Bhagavatam? It says that for every rising and setting of the sun, another day is lost, except for those who have spent that time, gunanuvarnam, uttamashloka gunanuvarnam, glorifying the Lord, or in relationship to service to the Lord. And that's not a waste of time. So we should, as Chanika Pandit here is saying, Prabhupada is quoting Chanika, right? The actual quote is that you cannot buy back a moment of time for all the gold in the world. So the idea, therefore, is that we should use our time wisely. We should use our time because it's a great gift. The human form is a great gift. And then the time that we have in this human body is a gift. So we should use it wisely. Some thoughts
on time.
Yes.
Probably the last sentence of that paragraph, time is not subject to any form of psychology, nor are the moments objective realities in themselves, but they are dependent on particular experiences. Mm-hmm. And complemented by Srila Jiva Goswami's...
Yes, Jiva Goswami concludes that the time factor is intermixed with the activities, actions and reactions of the external energy of the Lord. The external energy or material nature works under the superintendence of the time factor as the Lord himself, and that is why material nature appears to have produced so many wonderful things in the cosmic manifestation. Go ahead.
So in the word dependence here, probably like the moments are not objective realities in themselves, but they are dependent on particular experiences.
I can understand the first part. Time is not subject to any form of psychology. So in other words, you're bored in this class. Uh-huh. You're yeah. absorbed in this class. It's the same amount of time.
That you explained. Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
That second part. Nor are the moments. Hmm. Objective realities in themselves, but they are dependent on particular experiences. I'd have to think about that more. I don't want to give a...
Okay.
Do you have some understanding? Yes.
The moment is passing, but that's not the reality. But the experience that a living entity undergoes, that's real.
Okay.
No, and the time is the one, it's the agent that facilitates the interaction of the material modes of nature through which the activities are conducted.
Okay.
And through the activities, we are having those experiences. So that's real. But the moment that we identify in terms of every moment that's passing, that's not real. But the experiences that the moment gives us because of the influence of time interacting with the modes of material nature, and that's living beings doing the activities, and us experience the results of those activities.
Mm.
But still, the moment is a cause.
Yes,
it is causing still of the material.
Yeah,
the moment is the cause.
The time is the time. Time is the cause. But what Prabhupada is trying to explain is we. How we perceive is.
Use a mic.
The time, passing of the time, it doesn't depend on our modes.
The passing of time does not depend on our modes.
Yes.
No?
So that's where I got confused.
I'd have to think about this more deeply. For me, what's so interesting is it's something we don't think about a lot. We're totally surrounded by the time factor, right? In terms of our activities, in terms of even things that we just don't think about it, right? A lot of fear has to do with the time factor. Fear of old age, fear of death is connected with time, right? Time is important in birth. Time is important, you know, the whole six transformations that the living entity goes through, right? Born, growth, exist for some time. I missed one.
Transformation.
Yeah, the six vikaras, right? But I may have missed one. Dwindling and finally death. Those were all caused by time, right? Time is, so it's an energy that is all around us. Our children growing up, watching our children growing up, that's all the time factor, right? And we look back and we think, like recently when Janaki was here, Janaki, my son's fiance, was here, so she asked my wife if we had any pictures of Gopinath when he was a child. So we were showed, you know, all these pictures of him all shaved up and yellow dhoti and gurukul and, you know, all that sort of stuff. And you know, oh, he looks so cute, whatever, right? The time factor has moved on. It's such a powerful thing. So we see the time, but it's so powerful that you don't notice it day to day. Right, just like we've often said this, right? You know, your fingernails have grown an hour and 10 minutes since class began, but you don't see that. But over 5 or 6 days, you see the result of, right? So you don't see the gray hairs literally popping up, you know, in the middle of class, right? But they happen. Right? I told you that, right? When I went to get my driver's license last time, right? And my last driver's license said brown hair. So I just put brown hair. And the lady said, no. Those days are gone. Unless you diet. Right. Like that. So the time factor is such a powerful, and it's created here, and it's discussed here. Okay? Yes, Boo.
Krishna Prabhu. So my question is time only influences on the material on the matter, if the matter exists. If we see in the soul platform, does a time affects the soul?
No, time does not affect the soul. Just as the soul cannot be, second chapter of the Gita, cut by a knife or withered by the wind or moistened by water, soul's eternal.
So in that aspect, some of the yogic Mayavadi philosophy, they just become, they empowering the soul, and they are like saying that their liberation is like detaching their body from their the soul platform, and they are saying they are eternal. So in that case, when time is not affected, is it something that true? No, because like in the scriptures, that Brahma and like even they are all like in the soul transcendental platform, they are also affected by that time, right? So there is kashalosh, there is some what we call like
they are, but their body might be, but not them, the soul. Soul is eternal, even for my bodies. Soul is eternal.
Okay, bro.
And then I was going to say something else, and I can't remember what it was. Such an amazing energy of the Lord, time. Yeah, so we're eternal. Yeah. We don't die, you know. Ajo nitya shashvato yam purano nahanyate hanyamane sharire. For the soul, there is never birth nor death, nor having once been, does he ever cease to be. He's unborn, eternal, ever-existing, undying, and primeval. He is not slain when the body is slain. Okay, so text number 12. This cosmic manifestation is separated from the Supreme Lord as material energy by means of kala, time, which is the unmanifested, impersonal feature of the Lord. It is situated as the objective manifestation of the Lord under the influence of the same material energy of Vishnu. Or as you know, we say that we all have to bow down to the Lord, either now or at the time of death. Right. As previously stated by Narada Muni in the first canto, this manifested world is the self-same personality of Godhead, but it appears to be something else beyond or besides the Lord. It appears so because it is being separated from the Lord by means of kala. It is something like the tape-recorded voice of a person who is now separated from the voice. This is the point about thinking of time as linear. As the tape recording is situated on the tape, so the whole cosmic manifestation is situated on the material energy and appears separate by means of kala. The material manifestation is therefore the objective manifestation of the Supreme Lord and it exhibits his impersonal feature as much adorned by the impersonalist philosophers. So shall we carry on? I want to get at least, yeah. The cosmic manifestation is as it is now. It was the same in the past and it will continue in the same way in the future. There are 9 different kinds of creations besides the one which naturally occurs due to the interaction of the modes. There are 3 kinds of annihilations due to eternal time, the material elements, and the quality of one's work. Of the 9 creations, the first one is the creation of the Mahatattva, or the sum total of the material ingredients, wherein the modes interact due to the presence of the Supreme Lord. In the second, the false ego is generated, in which the material ingredients, material knowledge, and material activities arise. The sense perceptions are created in the 3rd creation, and from these the elements are generated. The 4th creation is the creation of knowledge and the working capacity. The 5th creation is that of the controlling deities by the interaction of the material mode of goodness, of which the mind is the sum total. The 6th creation is the ignorant darkness of the living entity by which the master acts as a fool. So, the purport, where did I want to read? The 3rd paragraph. The energy of the Lord is called avidya. It is the bewildering factor of the conditioned souls. The material nature is called avidya or ignorance. But to the devotees of the Lord engaged in pure devotional service, this energy becomes vidya or pure knowledge. It is confirmed in Bhagavad Gita. The energy of the Lord transforms from Mahamaya to Yogamaya and appears to pure devotees in her real feature. So, you know, we look out in this world and let's say a beautiful day like today with those beautiful trees there, the pink trees. What does a, you know, average person think? It's a nice day, right? It's a beautiful day, go out in the sun, have a good time, right? What does a devotee think?
Let's go on
Sankirtan. Okay, yes, let's go on Sankirtan. Let's go do service. Thank Krishna. They see the tree, and they don't just see the flowers. They actually think there's a soul inside that tree. And the soul is, you were going to say that, Manmohan, sorry. And the soul is part and parcel of Krishna, right? And they might even see that beyond it being a nice day, we still have to be careful because it's actually still, I'm going to die one day. You know, in other words, the devotee becomes very, all of a sudden when he turns on his Bhagavad Gita vision, he becomes very philosophical. Maybe to a fault sometimes, but, you know. But yes, we think in, and that's kind of what's being, so the what's avidya, or ignorance, can become for this, the same scene, can become vidya, or pure knowledge, when one puts on the glasses of Shastra Chakshus and sees through the eyes of Scripture, right? So we actually, you know, like in the second chapter of the Gita, what's, you know, we see with day and night, we see very differently, or at least we're meant to see very differently than the average person, because we're seeing through the eyes of the Scripture. And then things really become, then it actually becomes much more exciting, because even a rainy day can become really nice. Because a devotee, and we've used this example, a devotee carries their weather with them. They're not affected by the ups and downs of this world. As, you know, oh God, it's so gloomy, it's cold, it's nasty, right? The devotee looks beyond that and sees, you know, okay, it's another day, another opportunity to serve Krishna. Matter of fact, I can even show my dedication to Krishna because it's raining and it would be much easier to stay home, but no, I'm going to go to the temple and do my service. You know, they see beyond that, that they see it, they take it as a challenge. I can remember sometimes doing Sankirtan book distribution in Michigan in Christmas time. And we were out in parking lots, you know. In those days, Kmart was a successful company. Now it's kind of, right? So we'd be out, you know, and the snow was going, it was more flying horizontally than vertically because it was so windy. And we could only stay out for about 6 or 7 minutes at a time. You know, we had to go inside. It was like minus 10 degrees, you know. But it was nice on, you know, on the spiritual level because it was, you know, I took it as a challenge to, you know, go out there. And people gave bought books like crazy because they felt so sorry for me. You know, it was like that. So we can, the material nature therefore appears to function in three phases: as the creative principle of the material world, as ignorance, and as knowledge. As disclosed in the previous verse, in the fourth creation, the power of knowledge is also created. The conditioned souls are not originally fools, but by the influence of the avidya function of the material nature, they are made fools. And thus they are unable to utilize knowledge in the proper channel. So we should not be fools. We should try to see the world through the eyes of Scripture. And that's a challenge. That means you have to hear because we forget easily. So we have to keep hearing regularly in order to stop, not forget. Yeah. Some thoughts on this. Yes?
Looks like the material energy can appear as ignorance as well as knowledge depending upon the consciousness I am situated at.
Of the perceiver. Yes.
So depending upon how I am, then mm-hmm. it acts in the experiences in different ways.
Yeah.
It could be ignorance or it could be
correct.
Knowledge.
It's not really unusual. You, let's say I look at a car engine and an expert mechanic looks at a car engine. Do we see the same thing? Right? We look at Radha Madan Mohan and someone who thinks that, you know, idols are made of the devil, they look at Madan Mohan. Do they see the same thing? Right? Right, a software engineer looks at, you know, I don't know what it is these days with the programming. It's not C++, whatever it is, right? And person who doesn't know anything about programming looks at the same monitor or screen, right? Totally, we see things totally differently, right? Because of the difference is knowledge, right? Car mechanic immediately says, "Oh, okay, so you," and they can tell if you, they can tell so many things just by looking at it, right? A doctor, same thing, right? So similarly, this world, a devotee looks at it through a different lens, through the lens of knowledge, rather than non. So they look at it differently. Yeah. And so now the real challenge for us is, what about difficulties in our lives? We are meant to not look at them the same way a person who isn't familiar with Bhagavad Gita looks at them. We are trying to be trained to look at them through the eye of knowledge. First of all, take a step back. Second, see it as Krishna's mercy. Third, see what lesson we're supposed to learn from this. And then, what should I be my practical action to deal with this? Yeah. Right? And not to get totally, you know, upset and freaking out when something bad, because it's like a, you know, a speed bump, right? You know, you just slow down, you go over the bump. You don't just, you know. So, Jai Sisi Gornitai, Shishi Radha Madan Mohan, Shishi Sitaram Lakshman Hanuman. So so we look, we're trying to be trained to look at this world differently and look at the events in our lives differently based on scripture. Yeah. And that takes, we're going to fail sometimes, and then we're going to, you know, but failure can be the springboard to success. Yeah. So we'll go through painful times. Everyone has to go through painful times. Right? But we're supposed to see Krishna's hand in it. That's what we're being trained to do. We're in training, right? Just like you get a new job, they don't just usually just say, okay, now start working on this, right? They either send you someplace for training or you have on-the-spot training, but you have to get some training in order to do the job. So we're being trained. The training is sadhana bhakti and reading and studying. And asking questions and all the things that we do in devotional service, we're getting trained like that. So anything else?
Oh, Prabhupada put the last sentence, Prabhupada. By the influence of darkness, the conditioned soul forgets his relationship with the Supreme Lord and is overwhelmed by attachment, hatred, pride, ignorance, and false identification. It's not a kind of decoration like...
No, we're overwhelmed. It's like a tsunami of the illusory energy. Yeah. And then we become, you know, Krishna conscious for a few minutes sometime, and then we think, oh, why am I always like this? Why do I give in to Maya so easily? My gosh. So easy, if Krishna helps us. So I'm going to do something a little different. Because I wasn't going to talk about any more of the purports in this chapter, I am just going to ask you to read the translations yourselves, and we will start with chapter 11 next week. Okay, we're going to go, because I want us to feel that we're making progress, so we won't, you know, as like today, we were at a leisurely pace, but still we finished a whole chapter, or, you know, if we include the, we'll see you all next week. I'll be in Albuquerque this week, Krishna willing, leaving today and be back on Saturday. And one nice thing, starting Thursday, His Grace Bhima Prabhu will be here with his lovely wife. His wife is Srila Prabhupada's niece. Yeah. You'll see similarities in the facial. So they'll be staying with us for some time, maybe a week or so. And Bhima Prabhu used to be the president of the, for many, many years, of the Bombay Temple, and now is the GBC regional secretary for that area. Very wonderful devotee, a BBT trustee as well. Very nice Vaishnava. So he'll be staying here with his good wife. So we'll see them. And also, I think next week, I think Chaitanya Charan Prabhu is giving the Sunday talk, I think, yeah. Very nice devotee from, so we're getting everyone from the West Coast of, not the West Coast of America, though, West Coast of India. He's from Pune. And Bhima Prabhu is from Mumbai. So, different West Coast. More pious West Coast. So, Hare Krishna, have a very good week in Krishna consciousness. So now we have mantra meditation and then kirtan.